session number 23221, Reel 3.
Major Mole, Reel 3. You were saying that you weren't happy on your position in Happy Valley.
I was very concerned, you know, that something, you know, I was on the edge of my first action, and I was totally sure that something was going to happen, and I suppose it was a natural feeling of concern, really, and both Toon Sergeant and I took it in turns during that night. It was quite a creepy night and a very cold night. I had a wonderful thing called Nellie. Nellie I'd bought in Moss Bros. It was a sleeping bag that you could get into. You zipped yourself in, but it had arms and a head. So you zipped yourself in, and your arms were extra long, and you zipped yourself right up, and you had a head thing. And it was a wonderful, very lightweight affair, and it was my pride and joy. And when I got out of Delhi, my platoon sergeant got into Delhi, so we took it in turns that night, sleeping in Delhi. And I suppose the whole thing started, really, early in the morning. And there were sounds, of quite a lot of odd sounds, and beginnings to be sounds of bugles and that sort of thing, and odd lights appearing in the valley. And I think it was, I can't remember without, but certainly about first light, we heard a gunfire down the valley towards A Company. And I heard this splendid voice of a great friend of mine called Houston Shaw Stewart saying over the radio to his company commander, there's some South Koreans who say they want to come in. Should I let them in or not? And this character, Houston Shaw Stewart, was an Italian. And later, he's now Sir Houston Shaw Stewart of the vast estate in Scotland. But he was a wonderfully delightful character and quite vague. And so he said, well, I think I'd better let them in. And then, of course, all hell let loose because they were using this tactic of saying that they were South Koreans. And they got into the thing, and there was quite a battle started up in A Company.
And how far away was that from you?
That was quite a way away. I mean, it was across the valley. So yeah. I suppose it was half a mile away. The positions were quite spread out.
Presumably, though, you could hear it.
You could hear the battle. You could hear. So that was the start of the battle, as it were.
Yes. And they were right forward of you, then?
They were a little bit forward, yes, on the right.
To the right-hand side. Was there anything you could do to assist them from your
location? Absolutely not. No, it was completely
just too far away.
Too far away. Yeah. So that was the sort of start of it. And the next thing that happened, I suppose, from my point of view, was a corporal. I think I was not at the top of the hill at that particular time. I was down possibly the other two sections. Corporal came to me and he said, there's a couple of South Koreans have just come up through the woods, and they want to come through the lines.
Is the woods on your left-hand
side?
Yeah.
So I said, well, I don't understand. So I started going up towards the top section, when all hell let loose. And the top section was overrun by these Chinese who then got in, as it were.
Had they been using those two fellows as scouts?
Yeah, they'd sort of to sort of weaken the concept, you know, are they enemy or are they not? And there was confusion as to whether they were or not. And of course, if you remember, the whole situation was very fluid, so one didn't really know. And if you don't know about what to do in fire, when to fire, etc., you've never fired before, you don't really know whether you can fire at a South Korean. So it was confusion.
Had they been overrun before you got to them?
Well, then, the top section had been virtually overrun.
Yes.
And
was it still? It's just
dawn,
or was it becoming?
It was light then.
It was light.
Anyway, this chap then one of them started coming down the hill at me, and I was with the thing, and put his hands up. And I remember he was wearing padded, sort of Chinese clothes, held his arms up and said, "I surrender. I surrender, I surrender," walking towards me. So I got up and was going to shoot him. And my platoon corporal sergeant said, "You can't shoot him, sir. You can't shoot him. He's surrendering," or something. And just as we got fairly close to each other, he then opened up on me. So there was a bit of a melee, and sort of all confusion, total confusion, firing all over the place, etc.
What weapon was he carrying?
I suppose he was carrying, if I can remember rightly, a carbine. But I think it was a carbine.
Did you manage to shoot back at him?
I think I did, but I remember going to ground and everybody was firing. It was total chaos, and I managed to get back myself into one of the trenches of the section behind, and I found myself on the Bren gun and firing fairly fiercely on the Bren gun myself up at the top of the hill.
Where your third section had been.
Where our third section had been. And in the midst of this shooting, I suddenly found myself knocked completely out of the trench. And I had been hit through my steel helmet, which I was wearing, a hole right through my steel helmet there, right through all my clothes, but it didn't hit me. But I mean, it didn't even graze me, but it had gone right through then. And I was thrown right out of them. And I thought it was very odd. Perhaps I'm dead, or perhaps I've been... And people looked at me a bit oddly, and sort of confusion continued. And I then somehow got around the side, and there was a chap wounded. I can't remember his name, one of my riflemen. And then there were sort of Chinese milling around. We were all milling around. It was total cock-up. And I remember lying on this chap and telling him to keep quiet, because by then it looked as if we'd sort of lost the position. And I can remember Chinese coming very close to me, but not actually near me. And then a corporal, a Scotsman, we somehow got together again in that bottom trench. He said, "Come on, sir, let's charge. Let's charge them. Let's go and get them." And I think we sort of had the endeavor of fixing bayonets. I remember that, and trying to charge. But the grenades which we were going to fire, you had your grenades here. For safety purposes, you'd push the pins back. Yes. So that they didn't come out too easily. Well, then, of course, you wanted to fire the bloody, throw the bloody thing. You couldn't get the pin
out. Unbend the pin.
You couldn't unbend the pin. So that had a detrimental effect on our battle. And the great charge that we were going to take never quite took off. He was a splendid guy, and he and I, if we'd charged, we would undoubtedly have won the Victoria Cross and been killed. But we didn't. And slowly, we then got really an order from Mike Mulligan to withdraw as quickly as best we could back to the other two platoons, which we did.
How did you get the order? Was that?
I think possibly shouted, or
shouted.
Must have been by then, because I don't think the signaller was with me. And so I was then had it was covered in dishonour, because we had lost the pinnacle of the main point of the hill, and I felt rather sort of ashamed in a way.
What sort of strength were the Chinese who were attacking you in that location?
I really don't know. I suppose they may have been company. Company.
Roughly how far was it from your positions to the edge of the scrubby wood?
Oh, it was 20 yards. Oh. 10, 20 yards. It was just there.
So they could have crept up
the
wood and...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It could have crept up in quite strength during the night and be ready, you know.
Concealed approach.
Yeah. So there we were. Some of our men wounded or captured on the top. I think we'd probably lost about 8 men out of the 30 thing. And and we were back with the company. And then it was decided to call down a mortar thing on that on our own platoon, as it were.
On your pinnacle.
On our pinnacle. Mm. Plus an artillery shoot on it. So it was given a hell of a pasting, which was pretty worrying because you knew that one two of our own men possibly. And then it was thought that D Company would attack from behind, counterattack from behind, but they were, I think, were then under attack themselves. So B Company, with the rest of us under Mike Madigan, were ordered to counterattack, which they did, and successfully, after that, retook the point of the thing again.
What did you find when you got up to the top?
Well, we found a lot of Chinese who were, I remember particularly, they were burning. I don't know if some of our things had been phosphorus, tracers, but the tracer bullets had gone into them, and I remember being appalled at their...
Well, their clothing was burning.
Yeah, and their bodies were sort of, you know. Mm. And I think I'm very quite hazy as to how many we lost, but there were certainly a few of our men now.
Do you have any idea of the number of Chinese that were lying on the position when you got up?
I'm really not sure. I suppose half a dozen to a dozen, I just don't know. Something like that.
Sounds as though, having taken that top pinnacle, they didn't then follow you.
No, they didn't. Well, they didn't come down. They didn't seem to, you know, perhaps they weren't in great strength. I think they had possibly achieved what they achieved through dissimulation by this business of saying South Koreans. And I remember at the time and saying afterwards when I was being debriefed, thinking that perhaps they were almost being drugged. They behaved in such an odd fashion, and they didn't seem to be quite fearless, and behaved in such a strange way that they looked as if they were drugged, but whether I don't suppose they really were. But so there we were back up, and we went back up, and I went back with what was left of my chaps and went up to the top of the hill and started digging like mad. The sergeant major, colour sergeant, came up with some rations and some more ammunition, and there we were.
Had you expended a lot of ammunition during the...
Yes, and expecting, of course, to have to spend another night there with some trepidation. And we were in that sort of position, beginning to think about what we were going to do during the night and how we were going to manage it. When we got the order that we were going to withdraw, and that B Company would be the first out because we'd been the first hit, I think. And we certainly had one dead body. One of our men was, I think they'd taken some of the wounded down, but we had one dead body there, one of our men, whose name I can't remember now, but I remember we had a little, we had a little burial service, and we buried him in one of the trenches, and I took the service, and I have no idea, age 21, how to conduct a burial service, but I said some prayer, and we buried, and then we moved on. And there was no enemy action at all. It was all quiet, and there was no sign of any enemy. And I remember we moved down, right down through battalion headquarters, onto vehicles, which were just a few hundred yards back, and down the valley, into these vehicles and away.
When you were pulling out, this was in daylight.
It was beginning to get dark.
Beginning to get dark. How did you do that? Did you thin out?
Yes, we must have thinned out with one platoon holding, you know, yes. One section going. I think we were probably, I don't know, maybe we were last, I can't remember who went out, but we moved down that way with one section coming, one platoon going out before the other and one section going out before the other.
Sort of leapfrogging them back.
Yeah.
So you're passing through the rear.
Yeah. Yes. So it was a sort of weird, you know, it was almost surreal, the whole thing. And of course, there we were going through the rest of the battalion, and being greeted rather, you know, as things, because we'd been involved in the fighting, and of course battalion headquarters hadn't, and nobody else had, and they were sort of saying, you know, well done or not well done or whatever. And we got and went out, and of course we got in these vehicles and drove off. And we had little idea, of course, of what was to come for the rest of them, and that the Chinese were around there, and then of course this dreadful battle which Mervyn was in and the rest of them ensued after we'd left.
So your company got away.
We got away completely.
Yes.
And we'd no idea.
You'd had no...
We weren't as if we were told to go back and wait there and then them to come. It was get in the vehicles and off, and the battalion was getting out.
Who'd provided these vehicles?
I suppose it was the Americans. I can't remember.
Where did they take you then? Where was your next...
Again, I can't remember. It must have been into Seoul.
Yes.
To a building, either in Seoul or just south of Seoul. And it was only the next morning when we sort of, you know, realised the immensity of what had happened and the fact that, you know, a very large number of battalion hadn't come back, and that, you know, there was a great number of people missing, and that, you know, a really major drama. And somebody said to me, would I go on an Oster recce that morning over the battlefield?
Yes.
To see what we could be seen. I don't know why I was sent, but I suppose I was a sort of spare officer. And they said, will you go, John? And so I remember flying in this Oster over the battlefield in that morning, and you couldn't really see it. It was just a mass of tanks, blown up tanks, and bodies lying around, but there was no sign of any life. You couldn't see anybody. There wasn't any.
What sort of altitude were you flying?
I don't think we were very high. I think we were about possibly 500 feet. I don't know what we were.
Was this an Air Corps artillery spotter?
I suppose it would have been, yeah. And we flew around for a bit. And I think actually we did see some people, and I think we did a group of some people, and I think we sent a message back. And I'm not sure a helicopter of some sort wasn't sent in, because I met a corporal at one of these reunions later, and he said it was thanks to you, Mr. Moore, that I was picked up or something. I don't know. I can't remember. But I do remember when I got back to where it was we'd taken off, a chap said to me, Lieutenant Mole, he said, will you fill in this form? And I filled, and he said, you have to do another half an hour's flying behind enemy lines and you'll be entitled to the American Flying Cross. Which I was very sorry not to get.
He mentioned earlier on that the soldier called Lunt proved to be quite good in action. Was he involved in this first fight?
Yes, he was, because he was involved in that. It was either he or another one who came up to me afterwards and said, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't quite understand you, and I think I'll behave better or something. But we got on to a good understanding after that.
Did you find that there was generally a consolidation of solidarity within the
very much so. As a result of very much so, because, you know,
action.
Yes, it was, because it had been quite a thing.
Yeah. How long did this fight actually take, do you think? How long were you in action?
You know, it's awfully difficult to know. Could be 20 minutes. It's really difficult to know, because it's a long time ago, and one's really so vague about it. I really don't know.
What happened to the battalion then when it started coming together at Seoul?
Then, of course, they had to, you know, reassess the position, because I can't remember what the numbers were. But there was, the second in command had been killed, at least. Robin had been captured, various other people had been captured, James Majeri, who had been captured, quite a number of people had been killed. I think it was over 100 or so missing or killed in that dreadful night ambush thing. And of course my chaps had been killed and the other various people. So then of course they had to get up reinforcements as quickly as possible and reorganize the battalion. Then I can't remember what had happened after that. I think we were I remember then going back to positions on the river in Seoul, where we were near a bridge, one of the big bridges across the river in Seoul. But it was only very much a temporary position.
Holding position.
Holding position. Because, of course, then the Americans had decided that they were going to give up Seoul and move way back again to a further line, which was, I can't remember what it was called, some way back. I think it was about 20 or 30 miles south of Seoul. So it was again another major move back, as it were, having had that battle.
You mentioned that you had to reconstitute the battalion with replacements and so forth. How was that done, and how long did it take to get these new chaps into?
Well, I suppose there were some reinforcements at B echelon, probably, who may have been some reinforcements. There were certainly reinforcements down in Japan in Kure, and there were possibly in Busan in B echelon, wherever it was.
Yes.
So some of them came up quite quickly, I think, and it was about that time that I left B Company and joined a support company as 2IC of the Mortar Platoon.
How did that happen? Was that simply because you were directed to go there and do that job?
Yeah, I think so. I wanted to command what was called the battle group, which was it was the old recce platoon. I forget what it was called now. It's called the recce platoon. I think it became the battle group, and they had Oxford carriers, and they were the ones who were constantly being rushed forward. When anything happened, the battle group was the one that was sent forward in these carriers to see what was happening.
Instant reserve.
Yeah, and I thought this would be a rather splendid thing to be as. But I think it was the CO or somebody said, you're not going to join that because anybody who's in that's killed within the first 5 minutes of any battle. So I went into a second in command under a chap called Alan Hill.
How many mortars did you have?
We had 6 mortars. And I hadn't, of course, any training in mortars, so I had to learn on the spot, as it were.
Who taught you?
I suppose Alan did, and the platoon sergeant, and But I very quickly picked. It wasn't very difficult to become an MFC, and I really enjoyed it. But it was, I can't remember, it was then or a little bit, perhaps it was a little bit later, because we moved back at that time, and then, of course, it was fiercely cold. We were in these rather odd positions. In this terribly, terribly, I mean, the cold was appalling. And that was the time, I think, when we had put on white kitten of a snow run, and I think it's true to say probably morale of the whole army, and everything was pretty appalling.
Did you suffer casualties as a result of the...
No, I don't think so, except sort of, I suppose a few chaps malingered and possibly just really couldn't take it. It was pretty awful. And it was about this time, or was it just prior to this, that Walker had been killed and Matthew B. Ridgway had arrived? It was prior to this, because Matthew B. Ridgway arrived, and his arrival had a quite remarkable morale effect on the whole of the thing. Sounds like gunfire.
Excuse me.
That's right.
You're saying that Matthew Ridgway arrived and that had an effect on morale.
Absolutely. But Matthew Ridgway must have arrived just prior to this, because, in fact, he must have arrived before the 3rd of January battle, because there was a remarkable chap called George Prescott Westcar, who had been one of the officers in the battalion, and I must have been in reserve just before that. Matthew B. Ridgway drove up with 3 or 4 jeeps and ground to halt, and George was on the side of the road, and this chap walked up to George Prescott's Westcar and said, I'm Matthew B. Ridgway. And George said, oh, very nice to meet you. My name is George Prescott Westcar. I was about that. George was actually killed.
Sorry. What did General Ridgway reply to that?
I can't remember what he said. He was probably quite surprised at this British. Perhaps not. The point I'm making is that it was that by then Matthew B. Ridgway had issued quite specific and total orders that there was going to be no more withdrawal, that the army was staying to fight, and that it was a good thing, because prior to that everybody was thinking about how they're going to get back to Busan and how everybody was looking back as to where they were going to go, etc. But Ridgway did have his arrival did have quite a dramatic effect on the morale of the whole army, I think, particularly our brigade.
It sounds rather reminiscent of the way in which Montgomery arrived at Alamein and said, "We're not going any further back.
Yeah.
We'll die in position,
yeah.
But we're not going to go."
Yeah,
back
I think Ridgway was his arrival was one of the sort of turning points in the Korean War, without any question.
Had any of you heard of General Walker when he was?
He was killed, wasn't he?
In theory, commanding the whole business.
Not really. I don't think you. I mean, at that level, you really don't care of anybody. And so it was remarkable that we had heard of Ridgway, but its impact was considerable. See, our sort of main contact really was Brigadier Brodie, who was commanding the 29th Brigade.
Did you see him frequently?
Yeah, we saw him from time to time. I knew him because I had been his brigade LO doing trainings up in Norfolk, and so I knew him. He was a nice guy. I don't think he was he wasn't an astonishingly powerful or brilliant commander, but he was a nice guy, and I suppose he was as good as he could be under the circumstances, because his position was remarkably difficult then as an independent brigade under this loose American control.
How did you get your orders when you were in the field in these early actions? Where did you have formal O groups, or did you get a...
I suppose always through the company commander.
Yes.
O groups with the company commander. And
would he come to see you, or would you go back to company
headquarters? We would go back to company headquarters. And I suppose most evenings we had an O group, I should have thought. I can't remember exactly, but we must have had an O group every evening.
And did he conduct that in accordance with a formula?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Yeah. He was a particular one. Mike Madigan was a good guy, a nice fellow, but he wasn't I don't think he was exactly an outstanding commander, but that didn't matter. He was a good, solid company commander.
And how did you give out your orders? Did you have an O group of your own?
Oh, yeah, we'd have an O group of our own with the three section commanders and platoon sergeant and myself, usually, and then they would give it out, or sometimes, but not often, to the whole platoon, depending where you were.
How long would it take you to issue your own orders at platoon level?
Well, not an awful lot of time, because you see, at this time we were basically in defence, so there really wasn't an awful lot of orders to be given. It wasn't as if we were saying we're going to go and attack that or do that. It was basically, we were very much in the defensive mode. I suppose the odd patrol or something, but apart from that, we hadn't really been doing much patrolling at that time.
So it sounds as though everyone had evening prayers coming down from top to bottom.
Mm. There was one, talking about patrols, there was one thing, if I forgot to mention earlier, when we were way up north, where we were sent on distant patrols up in that Suwon area.
Yes.
By jeep. I remember going with a corporal and an interpreter and another chap in this jeep off on a ferry to a distant village. And we arrived there. I mean, this must have been close in when we were in Seoul, north of Seoul, but anyway, wherever it was, we came to this village, and the village was having, at that particular time, were having a meeting with the headman and everyone. And I arrived, and the headman asked me if I would speak to them, and here am I, 21, 22 or something, and the headman said, "You have to decide whether we should stay as a village or whether we should leave and join the refugees." And I spoke to my corporal and said, "What on earth do we say?" And we said, "We think you should stay, because